Good evening, everyone. We just came from a wonderful call, and hopefully this one is wonderful as well. This is 9 p.m. Eastern on 125-2018, Thursday, and this is the Committee of Safety call. And Captain John is ready.
Yeah, I'll do it anyway, ready or not. Hey, everybody, how you doing tonight? Before I get started, we're going to pick up on Amendment 6. I believe that's where I left off. Last night on our tri-state call, our Illinois, Indiana, Wisconsin tri-state call, Gary got into the origination of the Constitution. It's an interesting story, but that's not my point. But what is on my mind? And I know I've mentioned this before, but for some odd reason, I am compelled to mention it again at this moment before we get started. And this goes back to the Civil War and the reason for the secession. I read four of the declarations of secession from four different states. And I can't remember all of them. One was Texas, one was South Carolina, and I don't remember the other two. I think the other was Georgia. There was one more. But my point, when you read the reason that the southern states, pulled out of the Confederation, which they were perfectly empowered to do, was because the North was violating the Constitution. And I know I've mentioned that before, but I can't emphasize that enough. For about 12 years prior to the actual secession, the North was violating the Constitution. And the South kept asking the North to abide by the Constitution, and the Northern states refused. And so as we go through this Constitution course and the amendments, historically, I'm hoping that everyone shares with me the importance of what we're discussing here, because this changed the world when the Southern states were defending the Constitution. They were demanding that it be followed. And they seceded, which was their right, simply because the northern states were not obeying the Constitution. And in the Articles of Confederation, it states quite clearly that if the rule of law, if the states that were part of the Confederation ceased to obey the Constitution, then that dissolved all bonds. And that is exactly what happened. And somewhere I have in my records the four letters of secession. They're just absolutely fabulous reading, and it explains completely different from what we've all been taught in school, which is just a line of Horsocky. I mean, it's not even remotely close to the truth. The Civil War had nothing. Slavery was not the issue. It was about the North trying to crush the South financially and take over all of the raw materials that the South had, that the North needed to run their manufacturing. And, of course, the South was very wealthy, and they were going to continue on very well because Europe needed all those raw materials. But the actual dissolution of the bonds was because the Southern states were defending the Constitution. And for some reason, that's been on my mind for the last couple of hours, so I just wanted to throw that out there. Okay, so now we're going to pick up on Amendment 6. And Amendment 6 reads, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. The first thing that I want to pick on is always a favorite of mine. It says assistance of counsel. On many an occasion when our members have asked for guidance in some of their battles in court, there are times, well, we always advocate that you remove the lower court case to federal court. I mean, that's just a given. We can't emphasize that enough. But if you're looking for a delaying tactic because you're under pressure for being thrown in jail or being forced to do a psych evaluation or, you know, a fine is due or they're going to come and take your car or something imminent, and you're looking for a stalling agent, and I'm talking about all of us who would never, ever hire a bar attorney going in to deal with our court case. I'm making that assumption that nobody on this call would do such a thing. A good stalling tactic is to ask the judge, tell the judge that you changed your mind and you're asking 30 days extension to retain counsel. That's a very important word. Counsel. Now, as Rod Class is fond of saying, does the word mean what it, you know, you think it means, or does it mean something else? Well, I will tell you, it is my considered opinion what that means to the judge in the Chancery Court. When he hears you state you wish to retain counsel, he's going to rub his hands together and go, aha, we finally got you, because he knows that you're going to go get a bar attorney. Well, what does that mean? Well, that means that you've admitted to being incompetent. You've admitted to being a lunatic. You have admitted to being a ward of the state. Those are legal terms. These aren't silly little thoughts that I'm throwing out. These are in print. And that's what the judge will hear. Well, counsel does not mean bar attorney. And this is the point that I'm getting into. Now, Black's Fourth Edition, not a big fan of Black's Fourth, but I wouldn't go any further than the Fourth. I've used Black's First Edition myself. But anyway, the definition of counsel in Black's Fourth is, in practice, an advocate, counselor, or pleader. That was not out of Black's. That was out of Ket Coram, 307. However, Black says, one who assists his client with advice and pleads for him in open court. That's what counsel means. So this is a very useful tactic in the game if you need to stall. Now, of course, after 30 days, we would hope that we have gotten you to have your case moved to federal court. I mean, that would be the only reason that I would use this tactic for 30 days stall, because you just need more time to get your case in a federal court. So realize that there is a process involved here. It's not just a one-shot deal and then stay in state court. But I do want to drill home the word counsel. And as Black's Law said, I'm going to read it again, one who assists his client with advice and pleads for him in open court. That means I could call up Robert and ask for his counsel in my case. That's what that means. And we, by right, if we weren't involved with such a corrupt court system, that would be perfectly fine. Of course, we know that in reality, they come at you with practicing law without a license, which is an oxymoron, because they only practice statutes and codes, and statutes and codes are not law. It just really irks me. But the point is that you can, by right, ask for counsel, and it doesn't have to be a bar attorney. Now, I'm going to take this a little further, because this is something that I was going over the other day, and I'm going to stick with this for a minute because I think it's extremely important. It's called subrogation. And I'm sure that you guys have heard about it in one way, shape, or form. But basically what it is that you give yourself power of attorney and attorney in fact. Now, I think most people have heard power of attorney, so they understand. I give Robert the power of attorney to take care of all business in a court proceeding where I'm charged with a criminal offense. So Robert can now speak for me. He can sign documents for me. He can plead for me because I've given him power of attorney. Attorney, in fact, is more powerful than a bar attorney because you're not beholden to the statutes and codes. You can use whatever is required to defend your client. You can use common law, statutes and codes, administrative, whatever, commerce, contracts, equity, go for it. Whereas the bar attorneys, because of their oath, are bound to the bar. And they can only operate under the strictures of the bar. And so the point I'm making here is all about counsel and being a power of attorney and attorney in fact for yourself. I wouldn't actually do this in court, but it actually comes in handy in many other regards because I have always looked at the presumptions based on your strong, I'm going to keep this simple and uncomplicated, the presumptions based on your straw man, your legal entity, your organized organization, which may in fact be a corporation, we don't know. Nobody's ever proved it. We don't know what it is. That's why I like the term organized organization. But this is what they write you a ticket on. This is what they give you a criminal charge on. This is what a lawyer sends you in the way of a civil suit like your mortgage foreclosure. They send it to that organized organization, your name in all caps letters. However, you and I both know that's not you. You're flesh and blood living man. But because of presumptions, and I don't want to get into this in any great detail, I'm just going to spell it out for you. Because of presumptions, they assume that you are the agent for service of process for the fictional entity, for the fictional corporation. They can't charge a flesh and blood person. They can only charge a corporation. And they trick you into saying that you're responsible for the corporation. Well, this is where the power of attorney and attorney in fact comes in. I'm not going to go through this. I just want to introduce you to the idea, so I'm not going to explain it. But you do have to have your assumed name certificates, and I do it out of Minnesota. You also need to record your name, which is different from an assumed name certificate. Do it in Minnesota. And
Excuse me, John. You're on a roll there. That all makes great sense. But you assign a power of attorney, basically is going to get you out of the hot seat. But can you go on a little bit how that would play out? Very interesting. You know,
I'm going to finish what I was going to say, and hopefully that'll answer your question.
All right, I'll wait for you
explaining to people a simple process. I don't need you to study it, but I'm explaining to you that there's a couple of hoops you got to jump through. You got to have your new an assumed name certificate. You got to have your name registered. You got to do a status declaration, and when you've done all of that, and it's not hard, it's not a big deal, it's not difficult, it's not stuff you've never heard of before. You do a power of attorney and attorney, in fact, for yourself. That is the point. You give yourself power of attorney and make yourself attorney, in fact. And then with that paperwork, you're pretty much off the hook. And to me, all of these status correction processes to get involved, and there's 30 documents, and it's UCC-1, all this horse hockey, it's a simple matter of not being the agent for service of process. And if you give yourself power of attorney and make yourself attorney in fact, and you're in your car and you get pulled over by a cop for a speeding ticket, and you have the documentation that I mentioned, they can't do anything to you. It is no different than a bar attorney. Bar attorneys don't go to jail for a crime you committed. Bar attorneys don't get sued for your mortgage foreclosure. They simply represent the entity. Remember, they're not representing you. They're representing your entity. And so the point of all of this, getting back to counsel, is the fact that you can assign, there is a process, which I just briefly introduced to you, that makes you your own power of attorney and attorney in fact. And this is an incredibly useful tool with a simple process. It doesn't take a lot to understand. It doesn't cost a lot of money. And that makes you your own counsel. And that was my point. So, did that answer your question? Hello? Hello?
Yes, that you know, what you're saying there is real interesting, because that's like saying I'm no longer the agent. Talk to my power of attorney. And then,
it's,
you know,
all about eliminating yourself as agent for service of process, but you're coming at it by making yourself your own power of attorney and attorney in fact. This is an incredibly useful and powerful and simple and easy thing. And it all revolves around the word counsel. This is why I launched into this little tangent, because it's all about counsel.
And do you believe they will accept you then as a pseudo bar attorney under those circumstances?
Well, first of all, I don't want any, you know, this is where I've had this happen before, and I'm just going to tell you, let's not get insulting. Never refer to me as a bar attorney in any way, shape, or form.
I didn't say you, John. You heard that wrong.
You should see the bar attorney.
Would they accept, I mean, you being me, if I did that? Whoever.
They have no choice. It's all commerce and contracts. They have no choice.
Yeah, okay.
This has nothing to do with statutes and codes. This is commerce and contracts.
Well, my experience in courts recently is they have all kinds of choices. They do whatever they feel like, depending on.
I have all those. I've got 7 years. I have learned how to lose better than anybody on this call. Nobody loses as good as I have. I've done this for 7 years, but I have learned tricks on how to win. And you do not engage them in court. I don't go to court for the most part. Everything is done in paperwork. I don't even show up. That's the point. When you get to where you need to be and understand this stuff, you just send in the paperwork and it goes away. So when you carry, to answer your question, in a practical real world, when a psychopath cop on the side of the road, you lay this paperwork on him, you have, because you have a document that says you have power of attorney and attorney in fact, wrapped up in all of this is your fees. Because you are no different now sitting in that car than a bar attorney that you hired. It's the bar attorney behind the wheel. You can't give the bar attorney a ticket. You can't. They don't do it. And it's no different with what I just described. It is absolutely the same. You are not the entity, and you are not the agent for service of process. You are the attorney in fact. You have power of attorney to address these issues for the fictional entity. I don't want to get into complications. It's quite simple. This is quite, quite simple, but it's incredibly powerful, and it's amazing how all the statutory gurus miss this. It is so simple. Statutory work is just a waste of time. I tell everybody that asks me for assistance today, don't talk to me if you want statutory. You want to talk about this. I have jurisdiction and I have rights to travel. It's all horse crap. It's all horse crap because nobody knows the story behind the story behind the story. And the gentleman just mentioned a moment ago they have tricks along their trade because you don't know the story behind the story behind the story. Stick with commerce. Stick with contracts. You're protected by the Constitution. You have the right to contract. That is my answer to your question. We're not dealing with statutes and codes, chancery, statutory court, ecclesiastical court. We're not dealing with any of that horse hockey. We're dealing with commerce and contracts protected by the Constitution. And this is what all courts are. This is what they do. I don't want to have to get back into basics here, but a court is a bank. Why do you think they call it a charge? Why do you think they call them officers of the court? It's a money-making operation in commerce. Screw statutes and codes and all that other happy horseshit. So anyway, to get back to square one, and I don't want to digress too much further on this, the fact that I just wanted to introduce you guys to the concept of what counsel means, giving a trick to delay your court proceedings if you need that time to move your case to a higher court, and what the word counsel means, so you're not lying. I will never, ever tell anybody to lie or perjure themselves. It's simply a matter of playing the game. Does the word counsel mean what I think it means, or does it mean something else? I don't give a flying patootie what the judge thinks it means. I just read you the definition out of Black's Law and case law. And so I just simply carried it to introduce you to the idea that you can give yourself, if you go through the proper process, which is not difficult or involved, power of attorney and attorney in fact, and then you carry these documents with you that explains it. Now, if you get, you know, I want a cop, it's under, with that kind of paperwork in my car, I want the cop to arrest me. I could use a few cool million. That's not a problem. I would be delighted because this is a slam dunker. Anyway, I got off on the word counsel specifically to help anyone that might need to delay for a little bit. And then I wanted to introduce you to the magic of making yourself your own power of attorney and attorney in fact. So getting back to Amendment 6, and since we have a right to a speedy and public trial, well, anybody that's been in family court knows that ain't happening. Because they close the doors. Oh, I'm sorry, we're family court. You don't get a public trial. The doors are locked. I've had to beat on the doors of the court because the judge was so afraid of me holding a closed proceeding. And when the bailiff opened the door, by the time I got through with him, I think he soiled himself. And they locked the door and wouldn't let me in. And the judge thought I was afraid of her and I wasn't even going to show up. When I showed, and I am literally in the hallway beating on the courtroom door. So, unfortunately, we don't get public trial. Impartial juries, of course, we don't get that because the prosecuting attorney uses all their statutory black magic and already co-opts the jury before you even get started. I've been to many cases where you do not get to call your witnesses. They just don't care. And they stack the only witnesses that they do allow are the ones that will support their case. So, and again, it adds to have the assistance right here at the end of this amendment. It says to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. So I mentioned two examples. I can ask Robert to do it through power of attorney, or I can do it myself through power of attorney. And that was my point. Okay, so that covers Amendment 6, and we'll move over into Amendment 7. And Amendment 7 reads, in suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of common law. Well, we know there's a lot of horse hockey in that. $20 number is kind of interesting. I'm still working on a $270 million lawsuit with Freddie Mac, Bank of America, NationStar, the district attorney, the chief judge, two trial judges, and a handful of bar attorneys. Actually, more like two handfuls of bar attorneys. From one of the wickedest foreclosure mills in the country, Codillis & Associates, and the biggest law firm in Chicago, Winston & Strawn. And so I'll digress a little bit about those proceedings. And in context to Amendment 7, we came in, of course, asking for a common law court of record. And proceedings went on for quite, you know the game, so they're going to drag it out, and we'll knit, and they'll pick, and then I got to respond, and then they got to respond, and we'll knit, and they'll pick, and blah, blah, blah. And we hammered this judge three separate times on the question, is this a common law court of record? Of course, pregnant pause, doesn't answer the question, just moves on. Well, the third time, and you might find this amusing, it's really not funny, but this judge actually said in court, in the record, and I hired a court reporter. I have these transcripts. She said something to the effect, oh, that doesn't kick in until we're actually selecting the jury. And, of course, statutorily, we never got near a jury until about a year later. So you're not going to get the common law, and you're not going to get a trial by jury. They will do everything in their power to eliminate that as an option under their game. But, again, this has to do with denial of due process. When we say remove your case from state court to federal court, everything that I talk about here that they do is a violation of the Constitution, and that's a denial of due process. People ask, how do I write my paperwork to move it to federal court? What is denial of due process? All of this stuff is denial of due process. If it's a violation of the Constitution, it's a denial of due process. If it's a violation of the Constitution, the federal court judge has to accept the case. There's no discussion here. Now, we know in reality it's not just cut and dry, but that's the point that I'm trying to make here. And so here I made a point that they never allow me to have my right by trial, and that's a violation of due process. And so I will revisit that after the restoration. Now, there's a couple of notes that the NLA has put in here, and I want to go over that because it's kind of interesting. Common law versus ecclesiastical law. As distinguished from ecclesiastical law, common law is not a system of statutes, but rather the system of jurisprudence administered by purely secular tribunals. And that's from Black's fourth edition. And I will remind you that I mentioned to you the three tiers that a judge will play. You walk into a chancery court, you say the right magic spells, the judge leaves the courtroom for a five-minute recess, he comes back, you're now in statutory court. You say the magic words, you put out the right black magic spells, he calls another five-minute recess and comes back, you are now in ecclesiastical court. And if you know what ecclesiastical court is, then you probably might want to take a look at the Bible as being a law book, because that's ecclesiastical court. The Bible is a law book. And ecclesiastical court is based on the law in the Bible. And so I just wanted to mention the difference between common law and ecclesiastical law, because the NLA put it in there, and this is high-level stuff, but it's all about black magic spells and the ecclesiastical courts as the highest level. And when you get a judge to get into the ecclesiastical side, and he may physically change robes through each of these three recesses, he is bound. He knows that if you were that good that you get to that point, the judge knows that he is bound to the Vatican, and he can't screw up. And if you get to that point, you're doing extremely well. But I did want to point out the difference between common law and ecclesiastical law, and just be aware that it exists. Very few of you will ever get there. Now, they also make a comparison between common law and equity. Equity is incredibly important, and I mentioned the five different jurisdictions that are in the Constitution, one of which is being equity. And equity means equal. It means clean hands. It means if you walk into a court with clean hands and you're asking for remedy for something, and it's all a clean request. You didn't do anything false. You didn't create any fraud. You're not lying. You really did get injured, and you seek remedy. And equity court is incredibly powerful, but good luck getting in equity court. It's like another black hole that nobody knows anything about. But anyway, in the definition, common law versus equity law. As distinguished from equity law, common law is a body of rules and principles, written or unwritten, which are a fixed and immutable authority. Immutable means you can't change it for nothing, which must be applied to controversies rigorously in their entirety. You can't cherry pick. You can't take a piece of this, can't take a piece of that. You got to take the whole context, which cannot be modified to suit the peculiarities of a specific case. In other words, you can't make law from the bench, which cannot be colored by any judicial discretion that confessedly rests upon custom or statute as distinguished from any claim to ethical superiority. And that's also from Black's fourth edition. And it's also from Clever and Seawall. So you got case law there, too. So that's a very good definition of what common law is. Well, people don't, you know, there's a lot of different ways to describe common law. I mean, our founding fathers used the phrase, it's so simple that it can't be confused with anything else. And the phrase is, now my brain went dead here, nature's laws and the God of nature. The natural laws and the God of nature. I'm not getting it exactly right, but that's the phrase. And that tells you everything. That tells you everything. And these words are fairly reasonable too. And it says a body of rules, and I'll read it again. Common law is a body of rules and principles, written or unwritten, which are a fixed or immutable authority. So what we're saying is this has been custom over long periods of time. And our entire system of law, not the statutes and codes, but law, is based on 1,000 years of precedence in England. You had a village 1,000 years ago when there was a dispute over a piece of real estate, and the local authority, whoever it was, the law provider, whatever you want to call him, a judge or a magistrate or whatever, and the jury of his peers, by custom for hundreds of years prior in that particular situation, this is how we solve this problem. That's common law. Common law is common sense. Common law is custom. This is a fair and reasonable way with which we have dealt with this particular situation over a long period of time. And everybody and his brother, including our crazy uncle, understands that this is how we do it. That's common law as opposed to equity. Okay. So now I'm going to move on to Amendment 8. Yeah, it's a shorty, but it's important. Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel or unusual punishments inflicted. Now, here's something that may ring a bell with you. I'm dealing with a situation here in Illinois with a retired person on a fixed income and kept forgetting to pay her tollway transponder. She didn't keep up with it. So, you know, and she just didn't keep up with it. And so the state of Illinois came after her and started assessing fines. And, of course, you have X amount of days to pay or it goes up even higher. Well, guess what? If I remember correctly, it was roughly maybe $200 in tolls, and they wanted something like $5,000 in fines. So here we have a violation of the Eighth Amendment for excessive fines imposed. And I think that everyone on this call has probably run into that situation somewhere along the line. Whether it was a parking ticket or a red light ticket or you didn't cut your grass because you lived on the street corner, whatever. We've all run into the cabal. Look, I could probably say safely, the cabal, everything is an excessive fine. So if that's not absolutely true, I think it's relatively true. So that's a pet peeve of mine, and that is a denial of due process. And this may not be something that you thought about in approaching the situation. And that's how I'm looking at this particular situation. This is a violation of the Eighth Amendment. And, I've got some other sweet talk that I'm working with the Chief Executive Officer of the Illinois Tollway Authority. I told you guys, I don't deal with anybody but the top dog. But if he doesn't want to play ball, or I can't do the poker bluff to get him to cut this crap out, then I will put a case together in federal court, and this will be one of the denials of due process, excessive fines. And, of course, it does mention nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. I don't even want to get into that Pandora's box because I have no idea. My definition of what is cruel and unusual, I think, will vary greatly from yours. And so I don't want to say too much about that. All right, so we'll move on to Amendment 9. And Amendment 9 says, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. And so, again, we're hinting, and this is why I took a moment to talk about common law. So they're mentioning in the Constitution that, for example, I could say the Constitution is not in violation of your natural and unalienable rights. That's one way to look at what this amendment says. Another way to look at it is what we just talked about a moment ago, which is it does not violate common law. It does not deny or disparage others retained by the people. That whole story of we've been doing it for 800 years under this particular situation, this is how we do it. The Constitution, this amendment guarantees the Constitution will never violate that way of doing things. And so that's what Amendment 9 is all about. And in fact, our NLA note says, provides that all unalienable rights rank equal with those enumerated in the Constitution. So there's a third way of saying that. Okay. So now we get into Amendment 10. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Hell a frickin' Julia. That's probably the most active amendment that we got going today. Jefferson said something to the effect that the Constitution and the Bill of Prohibition was meant to chain the government, not the people. Something to that effect. And that's exactly right. And so we have this U.S. corporation running amok, assuming all of these controls that they were never given in the Constitution. Last week, I reminded you that the states are the employer and the central government, a.k.a. federal government, if we had one, because we have a corporation, is the employee. And we tell them what to do. And I know Chris Ann Hall goes absolutely kablooey on this subject. She can run with this for days and weeks and months. I love listening to her. The Constitution does not provide the corporation, or if it was the Republic, the central government, the ability to do the things that they're doing. If it's not, you know, like Scalia said, the Constitution says what it says, and it doesn't say what it doesn't say. And there's a corollary in law or a maximum law that says if it doesn't say so in the law, then it doesn't say so. So there's several ways of looking at this. But Amendment 10 is our most important amendment. In fact, that's why you have this very wonderful law group out there called the Tenth Amendment Center. They know that this is the beginning and the end of all arguments we have with a rogue government. So a lot more than has to be discussed there. Since Amendment 10, and we're good on that. And I am going to stop there for tonight, and we'll pick up on Amendment 11 next week. And so I now yield, and I open up the floor.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Now, all of this talk about when you get a ticket and then you go to a higher court, I can understand some of that and see how it works. But what about these poor people like the Bundys who get drug into federal court? Where do they go from there? Because who do they appeal to? Do they have to go to, like, the Federal Court of Appeals is the only court in the whole country that can hear constitutional questions, is what I've heard, and that's in New York.
This, you should know the answer to this question, because it, the answer to your question unfolded exactly as I'm about to show, delineate for you. First of all, your question is irrelevant before the restoration. Nothing is going to happen before the restoration, period, end of story. I've told you that before, over and over and over again. The statutory gurus don't get it. People are going to tell you, I have a right to drive. I have a right to travel. It's all horse crap. It doesn't matter. But to answer your question and how it is done under current circumstances is exactly what the Bundys did. They educated people. They rallied people. They drew attention to we the people. They dragged in the media. They had people show up at the Mail Her Refuge. They had people show up at their court hearing. They had people show up at their trial. They had news media coverage. They took it to the people. They educated the people. They took it to the people. They educated the people. They took it to the people. They educated the people. That's the answer to your question.
The one issue that was never addressed in that courtroom was federal jurisdiction and the states owning the property. And that's what he specified in an interview after he was out of jail. Now,
and what did I just say a minute ago? Before the restoration, so what? They don't care. And unless you got 10,000 guns to go in to that jurisdiction and demand that they pay attention to it, you got nothing until after the restoration.
I see. So it's all a
period.
It doesn't.
I'm not denigrating your point in any way, shape, or form. You're perfectly right. I don't care because they don't care. Let's work from ideal to real. We at the NLA are solving the problem. We're educating our own membership, and we're asking our own membership to start up committees of safety and take back their county, and the first order of business is to go out into your county and educate the people. Our solution until the restoration is about education. And in fact, this will be our job, our mandate for years and years and years after the restoration, after the republic is back, after all these people have been arrested, after the global currency reset. Now what? Well, now what? Because you got to take back your county. All of a sudden, the nanny state is gone. You got to stand up on your own 2 feet, change your diapers, and start to put things back, put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And the only way that we can do this is through education, which is what we're doing right now, and that's what the Bundys did. And they were very, very, very successful. And the reason, you know, obviously these guys had balls of steel. And they were willing to die for their stuff. I'm willing to die for the stuff I do. Scares the shit out of sheriffs. I'm telling you. And I try to get the word out. I go in public speak. I work with these calls. I assist people to call me. I do everything I can to share the knowledge that we all should have. And so that's our situation. It's simply that's where we are.
Jack,
so we can do little trick. Go ahead.
I want to point out to the fellow who was asking the question that the Tenth Amendment, okay, and for you to say that the Tenth Amendment is pretty much what we hang our hat on. There has been some subtle changes, and this goes back to education, because in the 1755 dictionary, there was only one definition. Well, there was many definitions for state, small letter s, but there in 1785 and the 1830, Johnson's Dictionary of the English Language had the capitalized state, capital S, small letter T-A-T-E-S, like United States, Union of States, this state, that state, that meant nobility. So right there, they were telling us by the font and the pica that they were using what they were doing. Last week, when we touched on this subject, on January 18th, I went ahead and I put a link in there so that you can see how the subtle change in the books to make it mean what they wanted it to mean. I have in there the 10th Amendment under the 1853 edition of the American's Own Book, and then I have the 1868 edition of the Voter's Textbook, and you'll see the subtle change in the size of the word state, and that is in the 1868 version, they have the capitalized state, and in the earlier version of the 10 Amendments, they, in 1853, they have the small letter state. So what they did is they subtly changed it from being, you know, the people to, and the republic, because the state in the small letter S meant republic in those early dictionaries. And
okay,
they just changed it all to the nobility.
After last week in the conversation, I rummaged around my files and found a copy of the handwritten Constitution. And it was sent to me, supplied by the Philip Morris Company, so that's suspect, but it was about 20 years ago.
Printed on rolling papers?
Well, no.
I had to take it.
I think if there's any good times, it was before the Reagan administration myself, and I'm trying to think I actually got that before or about the time Reagan started. But anyway, it's a capital S. It's a handwritten copy. And, but I understand what you're saying. That doesn't mean...
No, wait a minute. Wait. Hang on a minute. Are you saying that in Article 10, or the 10th Amendment, that the power is not delegated to the United States, that's capitalized, by the Constitution, are prohibited to it... I'm sorry, I'm looking at this small. Okay, are prohibited to it by the state, small letter S.
There's two states in there. I got to get out my Constitution and look now I personally don't like the part of the 10th Amendment that says that states have unspecified powers like we the people. I think that gives them, they're subservient to the people, and that gives them an opportunity to say, we have whatever we say we have, and of course we're all dealing with problems with states. And now I was referring back to what was that, where did we find that last week?
You're talking about the Second Amendment, right? That's what we were talking about last week.
Yeah, that's right. Second Amendment about right to keep and bear arms shall not be. Yeah. Okay.
Now, and you're saying that yours has the large S?
Yeah, I went and looked at my files just shortly after we suspended the conversation last week, and boom, there it was, capital S.
And then in the Second Amendment?
Yes, and I looked, and it's supplied to me by the Philip Morris Company in some ordering I did. And, you know, so I says, well, is that, you know, suspect?
Well,
yeah,
is...
Have you looked at a handwritten Constitution copy yourself for verification?
Actually, I have not looked at the amendments in that because my focus has been even earlier. But what I'm asking though is when was that the handwritten copy done? Do you know what year it was done?
I'm guessing it was probably done around 1982, 1983 that I mailed.
No! You said the certified copy, correct?
I have no idea if it's certified. I just ordered it. I can't remember except that I got it in the mail, and it was supplied by the Philip Morris Company.
Okay. I would suggest that you find the handwritten copy, you know, like online in the Congressional Library or the Library of Congress.
Have you seen one, and is it a small S?
No, I haven't looked, but I will.
Yeah, okay.
You piqued my curiosity, and it's another rabbit hole. Thank you.
Okay, I want to slip something in here on both comments. The first one is real easy. I had mentioned earlier today, I might use up the blacks fourth, but I usually use blacks first. Rule of thumb. The more modern the book, the more recent the edition, the more it lies.
Yes.
And that is why I use blacks first edition. Now, with that, I can solve this situation as an investigator, as a detective, as a forensic analyst. And I also happen to believe this, and this is what I don't do beliefs. You know that. This is what I know you should do. There are questions. There are very serious questions we're not going to get into here, the way the Constitution was formatted and the amendments. That said, the original documents, you always go back to the source. So when you get into these conversations, in my mind, I'm thinking, when you get into conversation, the capital S's and small S's and this written edition and that print, go back to the Articles of Confederation. There's never been any monkey business with that. It is where you go into the text and find out where they use a capital S and where they use a small s. And you go back to that context by which you should make all other judgments. And that's the point that I wish to make, and I yield.
10-4. And if we can go back to what you were saying about the Articles of Confederation, what they miseducated us about the Civil War, I'm there reading that 6-8 months ago, and I go, wait a minute, the Confederacy, the South, that's about the Articles of Confederation. That's why they call themselves the Confederacy. I have been lied to.
Bingo.
Mm-hmm.
Bingo. That is correct, sir. Cookies are on the way.
Yeah, and There's some evidence that the quote slaves down there, you know, when I compare them with the people who worked in the mines, you know, up here, they had sunshine, fresh air, and everything, and it was they were becoming sharecroppers. They were, you know, the land was being divided amongst them, and you know, that was their tenure, you know, so to speak, under a feudal system.
Good nature, goodwill. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm glad you threw in the words under a feudal system, because, you know, since the Dark Ages, that's exactly what the feudal system was. This was nothing new. This was how Europe had been run for 1,000 years.
And actually, in Bouvier's Law Dictionary in 1856, if you look up feudal feudal law. Feudal law. You'll see that one of the definitions in there is, or he goes on to say, you know, I guess the last thing in there is that it is a part of our system here in the United States that it was never really done away with. And the only way to get rid of it is through legislation. And, of course, the legislation has been making it more and more of a feudalistic system under the corporate feudalism than erasing it totally from our system. But go to Bouvier's and take a look at that, Bouvier's and feudal law, and you'll see that it has not been done away with here. It's just come under corporate control. And that goes back to the Bundys. That, you know, they don't own the land, you know. Yeah. I'm dealing with the same thing here at this present time, you know, in my area. So the land was paid for with gold and silver, and, you know, they're claiming that this, that, and the other thing, and, you know, zoning ordinances and stuff like that, and they have no authority. It's fee simple absolute or allodial based on their own laws. But they're not even recognizing it.
Understood.
Yes.
Back to Amendment 8, you know, there are things in the Constitution that the way they were written, that the founders obviously were, you know, we the people were in charge when the Constitution was written, so wording was not perfect. And Amendment 8, nor excessive fines imposed, they fine us constantly, like John said, excessively. If you argue the point, it goes nowhere because they're in control rather than we, the people, were in control when we wrote the Constitution or the Articles of Confederation, I should say, or the Bill of Rights. So, you know, that's something to deal with. You know, if we ever, as we, the people, got to a point to change amendments, void them, rewrite them, certainly, I agree with from after number 10, trash them all and just stick with the original Bill of Prohibitions. So,
I just want to make
Amendment
two
11.
Points here. The first of which is I remembered the phrasing. It's the laws of nature and nature's God. That's what I was trying to say earlier. But talking about being ignored, here's the thing. We have NLA members that this have spoken of their situation, and I was involved with assisting them, that have taken their case to the federal court. And because it was in federal court and the judge agreed to hear the case, the county dropped all the charges. Well, isn't that what you want them to do anyway? Just leave me alone and go away? That's the point. Yeah. The federal court had it gone to trial, may have, in fact, ignored it as well. But the lower court and the county didn't want to take that chance. And this is another reason why we tell you to go to federal court, because the lower court doohickeys will drop the case. They'll back off. And I can think of several cases, almost one hand's worth, last year with our NLA members who did this, who had that reaction. So, yes, I agree. If the went to trial in federal court, you might end up with the same deal. But the point is, it's a poker bluff, and it didn't go, and the lower court dropped the charges. And that's the point I wanted to make, and I yield.
And to add to what you were saying earlier, in lower courts, when you said it's a waste of time to talk statutorily, you'll just bury yourself. It's like suicide. Any papers that you plead in lower courts, you always plead it in the form of a special appearance. John Durash mentioned that Monday night, and that's what I did. And that way you are not submitting to the jurisdiction of the court. You're just talking to the court, special appearance, and people should take note of that. Title any documentation, special appearance, and I will yield myself.
Okay.
Shocking, though, that Confederacy, the South, Articles of Confederation, shocking, you know. We were lied to, you know.
Yep, it was the South defending the Constitution.
if you go deeper
they
into
were the ones defending the Constitution. It's clear as a bell. It's not even up for discussion.
And they flat out got screwed. I mean, if you go deeper into that, it looks like England was helping finance the North.
The Rothschilds were through England was financing both sides, as they always have done.
And in the end, the South was depending upon getting a loan from France, and France was talking like they were going to get it, but in the end they didn't, and then surely that was part of the Rothschild plan.
That was all part of the ruse, yep.
And so they got royally, you know, circumcised in the South, you could call it, worse than that, so. And,
well, we were talking last night in our conversation, 10 years prior to the Revolution, there were, I'm not going to remember it, there were two states upon the ratification of the Articles of Confederation that said that they were going to retain their own sovereignty, and one of which was South Carolina. And, of course, according to the rule of law, if a state was admitted with a special exception such as that, then that would apply to everybody. So those that said the Articles of Confederation were insoluble, they're full of crap, or that the Union is insoluble is full of crap. Point being, 10 years before the Revolution, the president of the Republic of South Carolina, more commonly referred to for our purposes in our books as a sovereign state, the president of South Carolina mustered its own army and marched down to the waterfront and took all the British ships with the guise of a couple of hundred of South Carolinians dressed up as Indians. This is 10 years before the Boston Tea Party. And ran King George and his tax collectors and his ships out of town. This is history. South Carolina was 10 years ahead of the curve.
I got that part in history. I recall that. So part of that is that we just consent to control in South Carolina. Circa at that historical time said, the heck with that. And ran them off.
Well, that's why I took issue with something you said a little earlier. Well, that just means the states can make up whatever they want and say whatever they want. Exactly. That's the frickin' definition of sovereignty. I took issue with that statement you made. Of course they can. They're sovereign. They can make up whatever laws that their people agree to. They're sovereign.
Yeah.
Of course
yeah,
they can.
Yeah. Right.
Hello?
Now, we the people.
Yes, go ahead.
Hello. Yeah,
hello.
Hi.
Are you doing your FM late night voice?
Yeah, I had about a week this week. I went to the court. I put the subrogation in 3 times. They never would respond. I went to the court, the federal court, when I did the bankruptcy to try to prolong. So the trustee attorney wrote me up as a serial bankruptcy fraud, and I would not sign over my property in good faith. A serial is like 3 times. And so I said to her, you are my trustee. You are acting as me. That's what a trustee is. She goes, no, I'm not. So she wrote against me, so I wrote a subrogation upon her. had her as my fiduciary, and then the other attorneys. And I said, you know, because they all perpetrated a fraud, I asked them, can I have the proof of claim? I said, there's no due process. I want to see a sworn notarized affidavit when I took a loan out with the GE Federal Credit Union. There's no nothing. So anyways, I wrote the judge. I also wrote him up. And he goes, oh, and by the way, I hear you have a lawsuit against me. I guess the papers that John had filed. And I said, yes. And he goes, I said, am I a public servant of this court? He goes, I don't have to answer you. I said, is it my grand jury? He goes, I don't have to answer you. So now what do you got to say for yourself? And he goes, you don't want me as your judge on this case? I said, no, I do not. I said, because I feel this prejudice and bias. And so then he asked me another question. So he goes, explain yourself. Because I did not say his name that I want him to be on this case, he goes, okay, you didn't name me in as your claim, so this is what I'm going to do for you. As of May 26th, we're taking your property and you got to be out. Now, I have the warranty deed on my contract and everything, and which, as I said, the crazy attorneys all didn't do their title work and their homework pertaining to my property. When I went and got the paperwork, after I came out the car, I picked it up on Monday, I noticed that the person in the clerk's office in September, she put, because I gave myself life use of the property and all that, because I used to work in that, she turned around and put the attorney's name as second party. No one could have done that but the clerk. So I made a call today, and I spoke to the First Selectman's secretary, and I said, I don't know, and I don't want to falsely accuse anyone, but I do have the documents, what I recorded. I do also have the copy, what was recorded on my deed. And I said, I hope we can get this resolved. This coming Monday, I guess there's going to be about 1,000 people. Which I want to see if I can try to get some cards made up for National Liberty Alliance, because now everybody's calling because they want to take everybody's property on the WPCA. That means the water sewer bill. I put the whole thing together for the people because I said, first of all, unless you own a laundromat, it is impossible for them to charge. They have no formula, and the piggyback off our water bill, and you're paying the amount of units. So, you know, it's unbelievable because in our area, Connecticut's going to be the new Hollywood, and they want to take everybody's property. They also said they want to sell my property for like $200, which is like maybe quadruple. So this is the mess that's going on all around the country and in our state. What do you think I need to do? And I also brought my witnesses in the courtroom. So I will, and my next date is February 5th. So I just want to keep you abreast. Another thing, too, what I did is file a grievance up on every one of the attorneys that have put these false claims on us. You know, and they have to answer. Two had already settled my case and kept my money unbeknown to me. So they turned around and said the time was too late. I sent them a letter back. There is no deadline on criminal activity. And I still not have yet heard from them. And that's what I have to say.
Okay. You and I have spoken on many occasions, and I only have one thought.
And what's that?
It really, well, I'll just come out with it. And that is to come in as a treaty violation, and specifically the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. You're still playing a statutory game. I've warned people about playing the statutory game. But when you get into treaties and treaty violations, that's treason.
Mm-hmm.
And so your situation right now, it is so balled up. I'm looking for a stalling tactic. And that would... I would think that would stop everything because you're now coming in under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It doesn't really matter. I mean, there's a dozen treaties that they violated that you could pick. It's just the one that I prefer. And
treason.
Come at them like that. Yeah, treason.
Okay. All right. That's what I was thinking of when I go back on the 5th. Also, I have to share this with you. When I was in the bankruptcy court, and there was two attorneys, there was all attorneys, as a matter of fact, And so I knew a few of them, and this one particular one, they tapped me on my shoulder, and they said, "Oh, well, who's representing you?" And I said, "Myself. Do you know I did better than this attorney? She was being foreclosed on." And on Monday, the attorney was so shaken up, and she came in and she, "Oh, hi, how are you doing?" And she had the other, like, five attorneys go out to assist her against me. I'm not an attorney. And the only thing I stumbled on, but I'll tell you what, that subrogation letter was a powerful letter because
yes,
it shook that whole courtroom up. I didn't realize that. And so when I go back, so we're filing it again because there's no statute of limitation on how filing. I said, okay. I said, we hit a big nerve here on this. So when we go back and we're going to do it again, make sure we send it three times, but we're only going to send it, they're going to give them a two-day answering period on it. And I said, wow. But, you know, it's very helpful, and I also write in the grievances up because I send the grievances up because they got to respond, and I sent, and I got, make sure you, we got the jurist number because none of them are licensed. Attorneys only have a jurist number, you know. And we found out the oath, and I said, can I have your jurist number and the oath and bond? These judges don't even have oath and bond number, you know. But they gave me the jurist number.
Mm. I'm going to stop you for just a moment because I'm shocked by what you just told me, that they only have a jurist number, and here's why. If you understand the Reconstruction Act of 1871, you understand that we're under martial law, and you understand the Lieber Code. The Lieber Code is very, very clear. What was before is now. And this gets to style at Rob Ryder. And he has made a point of this, and this is an excellent point. And I'm shocked by what you just told me. Because you look at a bar, you go and look up the guy, the bar attorney. You look up his number. And right there, wherever in your state they list all that crap, there's a name. The guy's name is James Michael Henry, and he signs court documents Jim Henry. No. That's a style problem. That's an error. That's a violation of the Lieber Code. That's when you bring in the Central Violation Bureau of the military. That's a violation. And here you're telling me the whole state is going under this, quote, whatever the hell you just said, jurist number? That's a violation of the Lieber Code. And so I just wanted to point that out real quick. That's just, you just hit me in that forehead with a golf club with that one. What?
You know, but I always ask questions, you know. And
you think I can't be surprised? That surprised me.
Yeah, and also another thing, too, because we have such a small state, okay, there's we're the third smallest state in the United States, and we have 30,000 attorneys in our state. There's 169 cities and towns in our state. So you divide that, so that's 177 attorneys per city and town. And they're all on the payroll.
Crystal, if you don't mind, we're running a little short. We got about 20 minutes left here.
Okay, I'm sorry.
If there's anything else that you wanted to say, that go ahead. If not, I'm going to take our additional questions.
I want to add something. Is it all right if I do that?
I don't know, Crystal. Let's flip a coin. Is it all right, heads?
Yes. Go ahead.
It has to do with the lawyers. Okay, lawyers. Now remember, if states with the capital S are nobility, the lawyers are esquires, aren't they? What is their primary purpose? To protect the nobility. Correct.
That's what I kind of thought.
There you go.
And she's in the wealthy, wealthy state of Connecticut.
There you go. So
right,
that's it. And
like
I yield.
That's like being nice.
Crystal, what Rob Ryder has done, and this is why it grabbed my attention, is that he points out a few things. And one I just mentioned about the way the bar attorney name reads in the registry and the way they sign the documents. That's one. Another favorite of mine that is so simple and people do not ever think about it under the Lever Code, it said what was must be. And that was that every court document needs a court stamp. Now, I have never, ever seen a court stamp. I have only seen clerk of the court stamps. And so the point of all of this is what Rob did is he wrote a love letter, literally, to the chief judge of the circuit court where these three cases were. Two were in Illinois, very close to where I'm at, and one was in Michigan. And all three cases were dismissed because of the points that I'm making now. So that was my point, and I yield.
Okay.
Crystal, one thing you should do you know, I hope you get to hang on to your property. I pray for you on that.
Through Jehovah's help, it's going to be.
You've mentioned that the value of your property is a lot more than you hear it's going to be sold for. You should definitely document property in the area and the value it's worth for future reference.
Oh, yeah.
Follow the trail of if you do lose your property, who buys it and who they sell it to for what's going to be the higher price that might be in line with neighboring properties. That's probably what you'll find. And just have that for future
because I did the Board of Appeal and I won for the whole state. I did that work. So you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, okay.
And also a question for you. When you have the warranty deed, when the warranty deed is in your name, you own the property. Am I right or wrong?
Yes, you know, that's we got to get into the whole thing about how they change things in warranties where we're leasing the property and it's no longer patented like it used to be.
Right.
But
I have the warranty deed is in my name. And see, this is where on mine there was 6 MERS, okay? So that was all fraudulent. I got the documents pertaining to that. I believe I sent it to John already. Also, when they put their GE Federal Credit Union, which I just, from my understanding, about a month ago, they are selling off over $20 billion. Now they're in a whole lot of trouble. There's a lot of mess going on, and these are the ones that are perpetrating the fraud and embezzling and stealing people's property. But everybody's jumping ship.
You took this into federal court, right?
As a matter of fact, it came up about the federal court, and the attorney went out there, and she goes, "Oh, Your Honor," because I guess when John, they filed it, he goes, "Do you have an attorney?" I said, "No." He goes, "You don't have an attorney?" I said, "No, I don't have an attorney." "Well, who written that up?" I said, "I had it taken care of, and I just left it at that. It was none of his business, really." Because he was fishing, like, and he goes, she goes, "Well, Your Honor, the case has been dismissed." And so he goes, "Who put this writing on there?" She goes, "Oh, those are my notes." He goes, "Well, I'm not going to mess with it because I don't know whether it's dismissed or not." And that's why I've been trying to get in touch with John to find out exactly what or how I can submit the case again. Because definitely want to go full speed ahead. And also with the... I have the witnesses and everything else, so do I need to do another affidavit or whatever? Because this is absolutely crazy.
Well, you know, the advice is always to move it to federal court.
Okay, but how do I go about doing that?
Were you on the call earlier? It's all about violation of due process. That's why we're going through the Constitution and the amendment.
Okay, because I got on a little bit, so I missed it. I got to replay it. Okay.
And all you need is one due process violation for the court, for the federal court to have jurisdiction. You don't have to have all of them to write the paperwork. You know, a couple of paragraphs, page and a half, and you've got your case filed in federal court. Real simple.
Okay. And I got to pay for that, or can it be filed in any state, or does it have to be here? Because this is
not I am
here.
Not qualified to answer that question.
Okay, all righty. But if anybody finds that out...
It's going to be the federal court in the jurisdiction that the property is located in. And
okay.
And you have to find that out. And you just type up a cover sheet with the federal court designation, just like your state court, but change it to federal court, and you leave a blank space in the right top area where the case number goes. You leave that blank, and once you file it with the federal court, they'll give you a case number. And when they give you a case number, then you're in the federal court and you're out of the state court. So.
Okay. All righty. All right. Thank you for letting me know that. All righty.
Okay.
Hey, John.
John.
Yes.
I have a question for you about the five jurisdictions in the Constitution. Could you go over those, please?
Actually, I stepped outside to my car right now. They have a smoke, so no. It talks about common law. It talks about admiralty. It talks about maritime. It talks about equity. It's in that paragraph.
Very good. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
John, I'm looking of the word attorn, which is the first part of the attorney, and I'm looking at the dictionary. Attorn means to turn over money, rent, or goods to another, to assign to specific functions or service. So I am paraphrasing here. So the attorney, attorney not, that's what I'm looking as the definition. So attorney shouldn't take your money and give to somebody else. He should defend you, actually. But what they're doing is exactly what the word attorn define.
Yeah, but you're back into the statutory madness, and you're not going to get anywhere with that. You're correct. You're absolutely right. But it has no useful practical value at this very moment.
No, this is not like, you know, I am making something. I am just, you know, this is kind of like paraphrasing.
You're absolutely correct.
One more thing.
Another thing, too. One other thing I forget. The attorneys are the debt collectors. They're the ones who are getting all the property. And as a matter of fact, the meeting I'm going to on Monday night, they are subpoenaing that because the WPCA, which is all attorneys that run it, and they match your sewer bill along with your water bill. They are the debt collectors. They would not show up at the Common Council meeting. So what just happened, the people on the Common Council, because everybody, I mean, you're going to be seeing this on the news, they subpoenaed all the attorneys, and none of them know the formula. So they don't want to even deal with the people. I think little Donald stirred so much up, people are really thinking a whole lot about what's been going on. You know what I'm saying? Even kids are thinking, which is exciting that people are putting their heads in, you know, like, wait a minute. Because I don't care who was in office, from the Republicans, Democrats, Independents, it ain't about the people. It's about the corporations and these lying people.
Crystal? If you have all municipal authorities, it seems like all municipal authorities that I've looked into thus far have got the authority to monetize revenue bonds on behalf of their municipality or their, you know, water or sewer authority, so on and so forth. And this goes back to the 1930s. So look and see if how your municipal authorities, and that would be the sewer and the water department, how they are set up and if they have the power to bond and then, you know, put the bonds, bundle the bonds, put them through the banks and monetize through the Federal Reserve System. And if that's the case, you want to ask, who is getting the interest on the sinking fund from these bonds? Because it only costs pennies on the dollar to print them.
Well, and now,
I'm sorry.
See, they came up with this crazy mess about in the 90s, you know, the late 90s or whatever. And I guess it was a team of attorneys that came up with this mess. And
sure,
now
it was working in other states.
Huh? Yeah.
It was working in other states.
Exactly. And but now they're going to the point, and what they're taking people's property for, I mean, these idiots put a $20,000 lien on my property. And I'm like, wait a minute. I said all my stuff was current, you know. But this is what they do, all these liens. And all of a sudden they go, they made a mistake. Oh, the price, we overcharged you, so you'll get $67,000. I've owned my house. I've owned my properties for 37 years. I worked a lifetime. And now this is all I'm going to walk over. Are you nuts to start all over again? And my property's been paid for. And they just, after my property was paid for in 2011, these nuts went and put their name on my property November of 2014. I said, show me the contract like I just bought the house. You know, they've been, but see, I used to do all this work, so I picked everything out. And I'm like, this is bull, you know? And everything I would ask, you know, so. I mean, I've been battling with them for the past, since 2004. And I've been representing, and I said, thank God I, you know, came across learning about NLA. And it's been a wonderful, it's been an interesting journey going through it. And it's just like, you see, when you go into the courts, they try to intimidate you. And I'm like, Satan's powerful, Jesus mighty, and Jehovah God's almighty. Fear no man. I only fear Jehovah God and Jesus Christ. And I always bring my Bible in there. And when they called me up, I said, I swear the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me Jehovah God. And I gave my name. You know, they don't even ask you to swear it. I said, I would like a common law grand jury. We don't have that. I said, anything over $20, we're entitled to a jury.
Crystal, I have a question. When you do, how you call it, you write the papers on attorney, how you call them? Grievances.
The subrogation?
No, grievances. Do you...
oh, the grievances. You get them from the state.
Do you carbon copy to the bar and somewhere else, or you give them directly to their hand?
Okay, well, there's a procedure in our state. But you get, you contact your bar association, the grievance committee, and you ask for the forms and stuff like that. Make sure you have the, you have to have their juris number. So
is the
any
juris number same like the bar number?
Bar number, yeah.
Yeah, well, our state calls it the juris number, yeah.
But yeah,
I
it's the bar
it,
number.
I call it union number.
Well, fine.
Okay.
Yeah, in Illinois, they call it the IRDC. That's the acronym for the grievances.
All right.
And sometimes
sometimes
it does stir the pot. Sometimes it does. I know of a few cases where things got hot. So the grievances shouldn't be taken lightly.
Well, and not only that, because if they get caught perpetrating a fraud, and I also contacted the Attorney General, you know, office, and I've been getting good information because they're like, I said, because, and make sure, another thing too, get everybody's name, date, and time, and who you speak to, you know, because.
I mentioned earlier in this call, I got a couple of dozen and a couple of dozen lawyers in my $270 million lawsuit. I got them all.
Yeah.
Everybody that ever showed up once in court, I got them.
And they want to pass the buck because once you ask, and I don't care where you go, can I please have your name? Who's your supervisor? Oh, people just straighten right up in there because everybody has somebody to answer to. And that's that.
Well, there's one little, you know, as we're drawing to a close here, there's one little thought that I want to put in everybody's head. And you've heard me say stall, 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 stall. And we are so close in this country to being relieved of all of this madness, the chances are very good for those of you that are in the stall process that this is all, you're going to get past this. You're not going to get caught and go down because we're so close. This memo on the FISA courts is being talked about right now. If you really understand the story behind the story behind the story, I view this as the kill shot. This is it. This is huge. And it's got everybody. And that's why I said watch the Clinton Foundation right after, day after the election for Trump. I said watch the Clinton Foundation for the same reason. It ties everybody together. And that's what this FISA memo is all about. And my point is we have reason to be very happy and very optimistic because our long, long fight is about to come to close. And we are that close. And we should all be very excited. And so, again, I repeat, hang in there. Delay, delay, delay. Hang in there. Because we are so close, chances are pretty good that those that are involved in process right now will come out okay. I can't guarantee anything for anybody, but that's my point. We have a lot of reason to be optimistic, and I want us to be upbeat about what's going on. Yeah, we all have our horror stories. We get on a call, and we talk about how we got screwed, and blah, 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 and I did a bit of that myself today. And I understand it. That's okay. That's part of it's healthy for us to have somewhere to go and do that as long as we stay in context of what we're discussing. But my point is we have reason to be optimistic. We have reason to be cheerful. Don't give up the ship. Keep fighting. We're going to be okay. And that's my point. And I yield.
John, one more thing. A couple of weeks ago, you mentioned this case in Minnesota about the mortgage. When the judge
the Credit River decision.
Yeah, there was attorney Jerome Daly. I remember this guy. I have a couple books on him. And what was interesting, I read about the five different comments from different websites about the same case, and they said there was the 12 jurors decided, and this case was in common law. So I'm coming back to Amendment 8. It says, and no fact tried by the jury shall be otherwise reexamined in the court of the United States. So if there was the common law, if there was the jury, because I also read that this case was overturned, but some people say they cannot overturn that case. They just put it like they overturned. And also one website stated that this is most quoted case in American history.
Yes, it's been the most scrubbed, most whitewashed, most lied about case because it unravels the entire mortgage foreclosure fraud. It was
Absolutely.
A common law court of record. It was ruled on by a jury of 12. It can never be overturned. And it laid out the entire fraud. It's all in the court record. But it's been the most whitewashed and scrubbed case I'm aware of in history.
Well, anyone
folks,
who is involved in the foreclosure should quote this regardless.
I put it in our in foreclosure cases.
I think we've been off topic long enough. I think it's time to close this call.
Yep, we're coming up on 9:30. So we will pick up next week with the next amendment. And thank you all for coming. We'll see you next week.
Good night.
Bye.